This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Is there a better place to be on a fine night such as this? I answer thee nay.
We're not doing a Thor book this week, Greg. You don't have to talk like that.
Oh. Well, in that case, hi everyone, I'm Greg Phillips. That voice you heard on the other line that sounds like nails on a chalkboard, that's Nick Duke, my colleague. We are the hard-traveling fanboys, and we are coming to you live.
No, we're not.
Delay.
That's better.
From Hoho Loon Plaza, at which sits the L-shaped studio that houses our weekly podcast. And we're bringing you a second edition of the Longbook Hunters, in which we, that's Greg and Nick, delve into a trade paperback or graphic novel and let you know whether it's worth buying, ignoring completely, or borrowing from a friend. And this week, we are continuing Black Panther Month, because by the time you listen to this podcast, Black Panther will have hit the big screen, and it's taking the nation by storm. It's expected to break all kinds of box office records, and it's going to be the talk of a nation. So what better time to sit down and review the most recent critically acclaimed run on Black Panther, the comic book, and that is the first collection of acclaimed cultural critic and writer Ta-Nehisi Coates' run on Black Panther. This trade volume titled Black Panther, A Nation Under Our Feet. A Nation Under Our Feet. And this is actually book one that we are reviewing. It's the first four issues of the run. And that is where we're cutting it off, because I've been out of town on a work conference meeting with power brokers and important figures from throughout the region, whereas Nick has been at home taking dumps and sleeping in his underwear.
No, I don't sleep in my underwear, sir.
Oh! That's a fact that I'm aware of, my friend.
That you are. I mean, there's really nothing more to say about that. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. As my mentor, Bobby Pierce, used to say.
Absolutely. A bed-breaking revelation, if there ever was one.
Indeed.
With that being said, let's delve into this whole book right now. Black Panther sweeping the country, Nick. And just a couple weeks ago, we reviewed the landmark first trade of the Christopher Priest tenure on Black Panther that ran so many years, in which he kind of defined that character for the modern era. Now, we skip ahead a couple decades to 2016, and Ta-Nehisi Coates, who comes in with a lot of cultural cash, so to speak. That's C-A-C-H-E, not C-A-S-H.
You know, that's true, but it's one of those things where I was vaguely familiar with the name, and I knew that he was popular for reasons. I'm not entirely sure what those reasons are. Like, I know he's described as a quote, essayist, but I don't know what that means, honestly.
Well, he is one of the foremost black voices in a sort of highbrow culture today. He's kind of a I'm not sure Langston Hughes would be the best comparison, but he's kind of somebody that he writes a lot of think pieces for The Atlantic, I think is where he is.
Highbrow. So you're saying he can't see how Publix would benefit our community. That's what you're saying.
That's precisely correct, yes. So Coates is known as a respected name, kind of writing in from an African-American perspective on important issues in the country, race, class, things of that nature, and has written pieces for The Atlantic. He's written novels, or not novels, but books, I should say, nonfiction works, just sort of things that are focusing on stuff like that. I haven't read a whole lot. I've read some of his essays and columns at The Atlantic, but I haven't read a whole lot of his stuff, honestly, outside of this. But in academia, he's a big name.
Gotcha.
But yes, he's a big get for the Black Panther. Like him coming in made national headlines to write this character, and he's a guy that grew up as a huge fan of comic books. He wrote an essay about how much of a Spider-Man fan he was as a kid, and how that character spoke to him when he was a youngling. So he comes into this book in 2016, gets to relaunch it from number one, and he chooses his artistic partner, Brian Stelfreeze, a man who's had a long and distinguished career in comics, also an African-American, I believe. If I'm wrong about that, please yell at me and send all of your complaints to my Twitter handle, at JRSBBQ. That's at JRSBBQ. Stelfreeze has a history in comics. I'm not sure I had ever actually encountered his work before this. I was looking through his bibliography, and I couldn't really place when I would have encountered him before, but he's been around for quite some time. So he's the artist on this, Coates is the writer, and it's a chance for a Marvel character to be presented by an entirely African-American team, to present things from a Black perspective that, frankly, as a white writer, you may not be able, or probably would not be able, to get yourself in that headspace. So Coates is given a lot of leeway with what he can do, but instead of blowing things up and starting from scratch, as is often the case in comics, he chooses to go a different route. He completely leans into and embraces established continuity from the get-go. He is picking up on the prior runs on Black Panther, on whatever Black Panther had been doing in the Avengers titles leading into this. He picks directly up from that, and you start in media res, so to speak, in the middle of the action, and there's already a battle going on. There are already players that have been taken off the board before the story even starts. What was your understanding of Black Panther's place in the Marvel Universe leading into this? Because I got to be honest, as somebody that comes in to this story with a blank slate on Marvel continuity for the last, 20 years or so, it was a little confusing to me because I didn't know. I knew some of these characters from the Chris Priest run, but unlike that run, I don't really get introduced to their significance here, if that makes sense.
Yeah, to answer your question about what was my understanding of his status, my understanding was non-existent. Like, I continue to know nothing about Black Panther, really. I knew the characters of, like, Shuri, you know, his sister, who was introduced, who we saw in the animated series that we watched, or motion comic last week, whichever you prefer. I knew about the concept of the Dora Milaje. And I knew about
the Priest run.
Through the Priest run, and I of course knew about T'Challa himself. And his mother, I believe, who was also in the is the Queen Mother, who was also in the animated series, but like
and
you,
the assassins, the Hetut, I can't remember how to pronounce it, but they were in the Priest run as well.
Yeah, but like you, I didn't really have any kind of understanding of what these characters were doing, so like you, it was a bit jarring to just be dropped into this world, I guess, with the pretense that you know what's going on. You know, honestly, it kind of reminded me in a way of the Kevin Smith Green Arrow run, in that rather than seeking to just paint from this completely blank canvas, both Smith and Coates choose to, you know, assume that you have some sort of comics pre-existing knowledge of the character and the continuity coming in. And for people like you and me who didn't, it did take a little while to kind of get caught up on what all was going on.
Yes, it's an interesting tact, and to that degree, it's also written. This entire story is designed to be read as a trade, I feel, and I know that, you know, Coates himself may dispute that, but it feels the way that it's written, like this is a book that you really need to have in a collection to get all the pieces. Because to my knowledge, Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember even being told who this antagonist is until the middle of the second issue.
Right. And I'm still not sure if that's something we were supposed to know already, or if that was something that, you know, was intentionally being dragged out. It's just one of those things.
I don't know either. Maybe it's something we were supposed to already know, but I didn't know. I didn't know her name. I didn't know her master's name, who ends up kind of being the primary antagonist, as it turns out. So this is a book that kind of drops you in the middle of the story and picks you up. The status at the beginning of the book is there is almost a civil war beginning in Wakanda, right? You have the commoners who are working at the Great Mound where this vibranium meteorite struck all these years ago. They're working the mine, and they have this kind of repressed angst and anger towards the ruling monarchy of T'Challa and his family. And this lady comes along, and she has the ability to exploit that anger and push it to the forefront and kind of expose the feelings that are bubbling underneath. Think of it as almost the effect of alcohol being a truth serum, mm-hmm. sort of to that degree, where it makes people's inner conflict and turmoil bubble to the outside, and they react violently and attack the king and the king's men, basically, and forces brother to fight brother, and it creates this horrible conflict that sets Wakanda on its head, because now you've established class warfare in Wakanda, which has previously not been there, where you've got the ruling class and the lower class is starting to rebel against them. And included in that is a rebellion even amongst the Dora Milaje, who are sworn to protect the crown. They are no longer satisfied with the way things are in Wakanda. They feel that T'Challa has neglected his duties as king and has put the kingdom at risk and has divided his people in the process, and so they are looking to fight back against all of the sort of turmoil that's been going on under T'Challa's watch without his knowledge. Women being raped, workers being exploited, and so they split off in the middle of this story, and they form this group called the Midnight Angels, and it's Aneka and Ayo. Who are the two that split off and become the Midnight Angels, this sort of like vigilante act in Wakanda. And in some ways, they are, and we saw this also with Priest's Run, where T'Challa wasn't even the main character in the early going. It's the same here, where T'Challa kind of takes a back seat to the story of the Midnight Angels in the first couple of issues here.
Yeah, and this was an interesting take on the Dora Milaje. You know, these two are kind of fallen, you know, have fallen from grace, and so to speak, have turned their back on what they believe Wakanda stands for, because they believe Wakanda has turned their back on them. And so it's an interesting topic to look at these people who are not necessarily evil, but just have a different point of view. And that's one thing I can say about it, about this entire book, really, is that Coates brings to the plotting and the writing of it subtlety and mm-hmm. an ability to not paint, for the most part, anybody as in terms of black or white. Everybody is seemingly shades of gray. Now, some of them are much lighter shades of gray and much darker shades of gray, but there is at least an element of relatability to pretty much every character, at least in terms of their motivations, if not necessarily their situations in life. Like, I can't necessarily relate to what it would be like to be an African shaman, but I can understand where the main antagonist is coming
sure,
from to a certain extent.
Yes, he's not a mustache twirler by any means. He is somebody who feels very much justified, and in some ways is justified. And I think in between him and T'Challa, you have the Midnight Angels, who kind of see both points of view and kind of represent that. Because the one thing that becomes clear in this is we have a very flawed hero in T'Challa. He's someone who wants to do the right thing, who tries to do the right thing, but in the process of that, seems to have done the wrong thing in terms of neglecting things that were right under his nose the entire time. And he's a character who struggles with that self-pity, wallowing in self-pity, as his mother calls him out on a few times in this book. And that's where Coates shines, honestly, is in the writing of the slow-burn writing of the characters, but in the dialogue and in the inner monologues and how they approach their lots in life. He writes it in such a way that is uncommon, I think, in superhero yes. comics.
It's one of the more literary feeling comics that right. I've read in a long time. And that, you know, I obviously am one of those people who constantly stump for comics as being legitimate literature, but this one certainly feels like something that is aiming for a greater and grander audience than the typical Marvel reader.
Right, and I think at times that is to its detriment, particularly in the early going. It's this book to me, I'll just flat out say this up front instead of framing it at the end like I probably should, but I thought that it took 3 issues for this to get going. I thought issue 3 was fantastic
yeah.
and turned it around for me. I was very cold after the first issue because it felt cold. It felt detached almost. It felt very cerebral but lacking heart and emotion.
And you know, I almost wonder if that wasn't part of the intention, because kind of the story they're telling here is that the idea is that T'Challa is not able to be the best Black Panther or the best king he can be because there is a detachment from his people. He is not really engaged with his people on an emotional and psychological level the way he needs to be. And so perhaps I'm maybe giving it too much credit, but I wonder if there wasn't an element of intention there.
Perhaps so. For me, it made it hard for me to invest and care about any of these characters in the first couple issues, except for the Midnight Angels. I liked them. I was invested in their story to the point that when it switched to T'Challa's stuff in the first couple issues, I was like, I don't really care. There's nothing to him. He's just a generic king character. And then in issue 3 is when we really dig into T'Challa and what makes him tick and what makes him move and what's going on with him in the situation. And then my whole perception of this story changed, and it retroactively made the first 2 issues better.
Right.
Because issues 3 and 4, but especially 3, really dive into his character in a way that I haven't really encountered before outside of, you know, that initial Priest run that we talked about. And even there, we didn't really get into his stuff later on that delved more deeply into T'Challa himself.
Right.
This felt like a really deep dive into the character and into his psyche and what makes him who he is and why he's made some of these decisions that he's made that haven't really panned out.
And exploring that idea of leadership as a burden rather than a blessing. You know, that's something that, you know, it was interesting to me because we've always been, typically when we see these characters like Aquaman or Namor or Black Panther, these royalty type characters in comics, we see them, you know, being revered or see them in positions of grandeur almost, but this kind of explores that idea that there's not always, it's not all fun and games when it comes to being a ruler of the people, and there's more to it than just being a figurehead. You really have to, you know, feel that responsibility for what happens to your people, and that's something I enjoyed about it.
And it dares to ask a question that most, I think, I shouldn't say most, because you see these stories in Aquaman on occasion, but it dares to ask the question, should there even be a king?
Mm-hmm.
Should there even be a monarchy? It explores the idea that inherently within a monarchical system, there is going to be oppression, an element of oppression there. And what you see here is T'Challa coming to face-to-face slowly. It feels like this is where this is going anyway, that T'Challa is slowly having to face the concept of whether he's outdated.
Right.
Of whether these traditions that have been there the whole time are even worth having or not. You know, one of the things that you see here is there is a distinct criticism of T'Challa's father from both T'Challa's mother, from other characters around there about how T'Challa's dad, T'Chaka, kind of set in motion he was affected by how much war there was, and he allowed that to shape his policies, and that in turn led to situations like we have in this current day, where you know you've got an entire country that's kind of divided amongst various lines. The other thing this book does very interestingly, I think, Nick, in a way that you see, I think Dan Abnett has approached it a little bit in his Aquaman run, but you don't see it a lot in comics, is the strong sense of geography.
Mm-hmm.
Because we pretty much have four simultaneous things going on in different areas of Wakanda.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the eastern border, the western border, the southern border, the northern border, and right in the middle. And I know that's five areas, but there's really only four of them where things are happening. And while you've got these things going on in the royal city, you've also got things going on the borders, whether it be the Midnight Angels, I think, to the north, whether it be the shaman guy to the south. You've got all these different factions. The White Guerrilla Army is going on, I think, to the eastern region. So you've got all these different things going on, and at times it's hard to keep up with, but luckily there's a map provided at one point that kind of shows you where all these things are happening, and how they slowly wind together as the story progresses. Like by issue 4, you're starting to see the things that are happening in these remote locations start to wind and mix together. And Coates does it in a very literary fashion, where he frames it with this poetry and these lyrical lines that kind of weave throughout the narrative and tie everything together.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, it definitely leans into that sense of geography, and it really helps to expand, at least for me anyway, as a relatively inexperienced Black Panther reader, my understanding of what Wakanda is. Because, you know, when you think of Wakanda, at least for me anyway, typically I think of, you know, just the capital city, and that's where T'Challa is, and that's where, you know, a lot of the action happens, that's where the Great Mound is. And this does a great job of fleshing out that it's not just the city, it really is a country, an entire nation under our feet.
Oh, does it make you want to take a walk on the wild side?
No.
Oh, that's just the manager, Todd Weber.
That's just the manager, Todd Weber, correct.
Well, nonetheless, despite Wakanda Wildside, which I, if not Nick, will always appreciate from our manager, Todd Weber, it does. It creates a sense of geography, and it creates there is a rising action here, because while I would say that the first two issues were a little on the detached side for me, again, 3 and 4 ramp the action up, and you get to see T'Challa kick some ass, but also some of these other characters kick some ass, and you see him in a situation where he can't seem to get the advantage or the edge over his opposition. Even when he thinks he has it, something happens that renders him vulnerable, and it's a vulnerability in T'Challa that we really didn't see in the Priest run that we read, at least that the first trade that we read, where he's presented a little bit differently, where it was almost like building him up to an audience that had never really met him before or didn't really understand him. And in this case, it feels like Coates' approach is, okay, you know Black Panther, now let's show him vulnerable in a way that you haven't seen.
Right.
Let's show him with some, you know, some holes in the vibranium armor, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit of what we get here. Now, from an art perspective, Nick, what did you make of the art from Brian Stelfreeze?
I thought it was pretty good. You know, I can't sit here and say that there was any moment, you know, that really jumped off the page to me or whatever, but there was also never any moments that really bugged me. I thought his facial features were done well. I thought, you know, he had a very consistent style. You know, that's one of the things that drives me crazy about comics art sometimes, especially when you can tell that it's been rushed, is when these characters look completely different from page to page. But he had a great consistency about him, liked his colors and you know, choice of designs. I mean, I liked it all. I can't say that it blew me away or anything, but I thought it was solid B+ comic art.
Yeah, consistent is a good word. I think Laura Martin was the colorist here, if I'm not mistaken. She did a great job. But yeah, the colors were popping. The art was good. Consistent. The lines were consistent. Everybody, the action was pretty good, I thought. You know, like I said, like you said, I think that was a good assessment of it. It wasn't, it didn't do anything to blow me away, per se, but I thought it was good. It was solid. It was consistent. And everyone in the book looked how they looked from issue 1 through issue 4. And some of the characters that pop up that I thought Stelfreeze did a particularly good job at were the college professor, whose name I can't remember right now, as I don't have the book in front of me. His scene with the queen at the end of issue 4, I think it is really strong. One of the strongest scenes in the book to me, and that's largely sold on the facial expressions and the look of quiet, a sort of this character being quietly resigned to the way things are, and the queen kind of disappointed in how their relationship has turned out over the years. Really a good job of weaving that in, and also weaving in the art, or the action, I should say, when it pops up, which is largely bursts here and there of combat, but it looks good, and it looks consistent and clean, and you can tell what's going on, which is a big thing for me. And comic book action scenes, I see so many comics nowadays, even from otherwise great artists, where I can't tell what the hell is going on in the action scenes, and that's not the case in this book at all.
Yeah, like you said, the action is very, you know, easy to follow and easy to understand, and I also really dug the design of, you know, the various Wakandan locales. I thought they all had distinct mm-hmm. feels about them, different looks, yet somehow had some commonality about them to really illustrate that they are, you know, one country. So, you know, had some really good stuff in there between the action and the set pieces.
So, what are your takes on the two villains here? You got the and again, the names escape me because I don't have the book in front of me, but the lady who manipulates people's feelings, and then of course the shaman who we've mentioned, who is really in touch with the planet, with the Earth itself, and has kind of control over the Earth. Not unlike a planeteer.
Yeah, hard to really get a read on the female villain because we don't really get to know much about her motivations. Like, we understand, you know, obviously what her abilities are and how she is a legitimate threat to Wakanda and to T'Challa himself, but not a whole lot in terms of characterization there. So kind of an incomplete on her, I would say. Cool power, interesting power, but not a ton there in terms of her actual characterization. As far as the shaman goes, I thought it was pretty good. Like I said earlier, it's a character that definitely is on the darker side of the shades of gray, but there's at least enough relatability to him there that you can understand this is a guy who has sought truth and, you know, some level of, you know, righteousness in various institutions throughout his life, and they all failed him, and causing him to kind of turn, you know, into his own source of truth and righteousness, and he's going about that by the means that he deems necessary. So it's an interesting take for sure.
Absolutely, and he was a really strong part of this series to me. He, as the series progressed, I wasn't sure how I would feel about him, but again, issue 3 and issue 4 did a ton to make me understand where he's coming from, why he's making the decisions that he is, and it builds the impression that T'Challa's really got his work cut out for him, because not only is he battling this guy physically, but he's fighting for the hearts of his own countrymen, his own people. So it feels like an uphill battle for T'Challa, and I think that's impressive when you can make the stakes feel that way in a in a solo title, because it's hard to make Batman or Superman or Spider-Man make it feel like they might actually lose this battle. But in this case, I could totally see T'Challa beating this guy in combat, but ultimately losing the war of his people's perception of him.
Yeah, the hearts and minds and whatnot.
Right. Exactly. So we've talked pretty much about everything I wanted to. But who were some of your favorite characters in this one? Did you have a favorite character in this book?
Yeah, like you said earlier, the Midnight Angels obviously would be at the top of that list, and then of course T'Challa himself. I enjoyed the brief looks we got at the Queen Mother. I thought she had some interesting scenes of dialogue, especially with the professor character, like you mentioned. So those would be the ones on my short list.
Yes, I also liked Gilligan in addition to the professor. He always seemed to get them into hijinks, but by God, Nick, he meant well.
I was more of a Mr. Howell guy.
That doesn't surprise me. Lovey! But no, my favorite characters were the Midnight Angels. They were great. What a great way to take an existing concept and instantly create two new heroes or anti-heroes for the Marvel Universe right out of the gate. So great job by Coates and Stelfreeze to turn them into distinct and compelling characters to the degree that I could see them spinning off and doing their own thing when this is all said and done. Now, I don't know how this run continues, what's going on in the current issues, but based on how this trade reads, I could see them spinning off and getting their own book at some point. They're tremendous and very interesting, and I'm curious to see how their interactions with T'Challa go once it gets to that point.
Yeah, as am I. It's definitely another one of those that, like many that we read, I'm interested in reading more, even if I know I don't have the time to.
Exactly. It's so hard to find time these days. It almost makes you wish you could lock yourself up in a bank vault while a nuclear bomb wipes out all of reality.
Well, hey, you know, if we
have time to read your books.
You know, if things keep going the way they're going, all we'll need is the bank vault in that situation.
Bank vault. You know, there's a bank vault right near your old stomping grounds of Columbia, Alabama, Nick. Did you know that?
I did know that.
It was robbed by...
Yes, by the men who would later escape from Alcatraz.
Exactly.
Don't tell me about... For our listeners. Don't tell me... Try to presume to learn me up about things about Columbia, Alabama.
Listen, you may have been born into the darkness, but I adopted it.
You adopted... You didn't adopt Columbia. You adopted those city folk in Dothan.
Oh, the highfalutin high rollers at the Dothan Country Club.
That's right.
They don't want no stinking Publix in their town.
They don't want no Publix.
They don't want no people in their town.
Mm.
Anyway, that's beside the point. We're getting into the weeds of journalism here, folks. And that's not what anybody comes to us for. We don't know what we're talking about. We don't know anything. We're just two guys.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we're two guys that have just read a Black Panther book and are now ready to give our final thoughts. Nick, your final thoughts on this book and your recommendation on it.
Ultimately, I enjoyed it. Like you said, it kind of gets off to a slow start, so I can't, you know, give it a, you know, overly enthusiastic grade. I can't say it's like a 10 out of 10 or anything, but I think it's a solid read. It's a good start to a run, and I think at the very least, by the end of it, you'll be interested in reading more. So I would say, you know, grab it at the library. If you can find it digitally, rent it. You know, whatever that system could be. I don't know that I would recommend unless you're just a huge Black Panther fan or perhaps a fan of Ta-Nehisi Coates' work outside of comics. Maybe then it would be a must-buy for you. But I would say just find a way to read it and then make your own determination on whether you want to continue from there.
You said it perfect, Bubba. I agree completely with that. I can't recommend blind buying it because of Marvel's trade pricing right now, which is higher significantly than DC and Image's pricing. I can't recommend going out and buying a four-issue trade for the price tag on it without reading it first.
But what you could do is just invest in 1 month of Marvel Unlimited for $9.99 and read it on there.
That's correct. And I would recommend, and actually, as I'm looking this up, the actual paperback on Amazon, if you have Amazon Prime or whatever, it's $11.55, which is not a bad price. So, you know, maybe give it a shot. But I would recommend, like, if you find it at your library, or maybe you've got a friend that owns it, maybe you borrow it, give it a read, see what you think. Or it feels to me like this entire Coates run is going to be one of those runs that we run into occasionally, Nick, where it might read better once it's collected into one
Giant volume.
Giant volume. Or, yeah, exactly. Like, maybe a 16-issue compendium or something like that that kind of tells the whole story. Because it feels like we're just getting started at the end of this book on what's to come. It feels like there are major moves coming, that Coates has a very definite plan for where he sees this story ending up.
Yeah, it's a run that's still ongoing, so we could be a long ways away from any sort of omnibus or something like that, but perhaps you're right. Perhaps it is something that would read better in that form.
Totally. So both of us enjoyed it. I think that you'll enjoy it if you give it enough time, and maybe you'll like the first issue even better than I did if you're a big Black Panther fan. So give it a read and then go from there. And in the meantime, why don't you guys log on to twitter.com, tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87, and let us know what you think about our review and what you think about the book. Did you love it? Did you hate it? Somewhere in between? Did we get it wrong? Illuminate us. Let us know your thoughts on Twitter. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page if you haven't already. Just go on to Facebook, type into your search bar, Place to Be Nation Comics. Come on along, and we'll have an in-depth discussion about this in a way that maybe we can't on Twitter. And also we have emails. GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. And that's about it for this portion of the show. We're going to take a break in just a second. But before we do, we want to let you know that Black Panther Month will continue next week with our exclusive review of the Black Panther movie. We are going to be joined by the host of Sellers Points podcast. That is Russell Sellers. And the three of us are going to talk about our thoughts on this film, which we'll be seeing this weekend. So be sure to tune in for that. And when we come back from the break, we're going to have Read and Watch, and we're going to have the rundown. In the meantime, listen to the commercials for all the great podcasts at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. Please stick with us. We think you'll enjoy it.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others available on PlaceTheNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceTheNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceTheNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
So I says to her, I got nothing to follow that with, Nick.
You says, that doesn't taste like chicken. It tastes like soup.
Oh, peaches. We're back, ladies and gentlemen, and we are ready to ravish you with the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast
in all of Place to Be Nation.
That was sloppy, Nick.
Very sloppy. I don't know about that. I thought it was pretty good. Sometimes sloppy is good, Greg. Sometimes it's good to be a little sloppy.
If you smell what the Duke is cooking. That's one thing that we have here on this show, Nick, is we have an undying appreciation for the work of one Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Indeed we do, and I would argue that it's an appreciation that's shared across all Place to Be Nation pop, as it should be.
Mm-hmm. I think that if ever, you know, honestly, I think that, you know, certain segments can have sponsors in the world of broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Nerd Eye Candy should be renamed the Dwayne The Rock Johnson Nerd Eye Candy segment.
I completely agree with that. I don't see why he wouldn't be a perpetual choice for Nerd Eye Candy.
Absolutely. It should just be unspoken at this point.
Indeed.
And with that said, we are going to kick things off this week on this end of the deal with reading and watching.
Reading and watching. What you been reading and watching?
What have you been reading and watching? Tell us!
And this is going to be pretty simple from my perspective because I've been on a work trip for several days and had no time to read much except for this week's topic of the long book hunt. And
Except for the work trip part. Yeah, no reading for me either other than what we did. I'm planning on getting back into my comics at some point. It's just been a hectic time, and I've been filling my time with binge-watching television instead of reading comics. And speaking of which, before we jump into the CW shows, I got something else for watching if we're moving on to watching.
I see no... Is there any objection to us moving on to watching? Hearing none, motion passes.
Motion passes. Absolutely. So moving on to watching, over the past week, watched the entirety of Marvel's The Punisher. You know, I had already watched the first two episodes and very much enjoyed them. I went back and rewatched those episodes because I was worried I might, you know, have forgotten some of the finer details. And then I blew through the entire 13 episodes in like 4 or 5 days, probably, over the weekend, largely, just kind of the first time I've really binged something hardcore in a while, because I was absolutely hooked. I gotta say, man, I loved this. I thought it was, you know, and I hate getting caught up in recency bias, and I know that's what this is here, because I absolutely love season one of Daredevil, but at this moment, I would say it's the best thing that Marvel's done on Netflix outside of Jessica Jones. Like, Jessica Jones is the only show I would have above it. I would have this even above Daredevil Season 1, honestly. I thought it was so well done from a writing standpoint, from an acting standpoint. You know, compelling characters, compelling plots. You know, something I wasn't really expecting from a Punisher show, because I didn't know much about the Punisher's supporting cast. And I found myself really being, you know, endeared to a lot of these characters and caring about where they were going. And it was at times a very difficult watch because it does not let up in the relentless, you know, depression that Frank Castle has as a character. And it very much leans into that. You know, you suffer with Frank through these 13 episodes, but ultimately, I just thought it was brilliantly done. A huge return to form for Marvel Netflix after the god-awful Iron Fist and the somewhat disappointing to some Defenders, even though I really enjoyed the Defenders as well. But yeah, this is easily the best Marvel show since Jessica Jones.
Very high praise. I'm looking forward to watching it indeed. In addition to watching DC's answer to it, which of course is DC's The Wild Dog.
Yes, The Wild Dog. That should be very good. Instead of shooting people, he'll just call people Hoss, and they'll blow their own brains out.
Oh, that popped me, Nick. That popped me. Yeah, I have not watched anything else, really, comic book related, that I can think of. So let's move on to the CW shows, Nick. And you're gonna drive in the driver's seat this week, and I am going to passenger in the passenger seat. So take it away.
So Supergirl, I don't believe you've watched. You mentioned that off air. Nope. That you didn't actually watch Supergirl. Nope. So
I have not had time.
Just in brief, this episode dealt a lot with the second world killer, Purity. You know, we kind of saw a glimpse of her at the close of the previous week's Supergirl. And so this one deals with the DEO kind of using means to track her down, bring her into custody, and it's very much looking at the idea of the fact that she is still a woman who is conflicted. She has not yet been fully consumed or given herself over at times to her possession the way, you know, Samantha has with Rain. Ultimately, in the end, she's able to overcome the pull she feels inside and able to, you know, embrace her humanity. And that's kind of what the entire episode about is, the question of how does one embrace their humanity in under the threat of such destruction. You know, Kara continues to be, you know, like you say often, just the best person, and it's Alex that we actually see here in this episode start to lean into paranoia and fear and start to lose a little bit of her humanity in this one. And so it's a really intriguing episode. Big bounce back from the subpar Morgan Edge episode, and I enjoyed this one quite a bit, honestly. And then, of course, Tuesday, we had The Flash, which you've seen this one, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so this one kind of dealt with Barry Allen making his escape from, you know, Warden Wolf's secret supervillain ward that he had there at Iron Heights Prison. And so you get to see a lot of the characters who made appearances, the villains of the week from earlier in the season, make their grand returns here as they are Barry's compatriots during this escape. And, you know, some of them are welcome additions back onto the show, like, you know, the guy, I forget his name, who shrieks stuff I enjoyed, and then the girl with the bad luck, Hazard, I believe, I enjoyed.
Jinx.
Jinx, yeah, I enjoyed her as well. But then other characters, like Kilgore especially, just continues to be one of the worst written and worst performed characters the show has ever had.
You mean Fat Nails?
Fat Nails, yes. Black Bison as a character still doesn't really have anything compelling about her. And then I'm trying to remember who else was even hanging out with him. That may have been it.
Yeah, I think it was those four and Barry, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So, you know, still an interesting premise, and it ultimately kind of, you start to get a glimpse at more of what I think DeVoe's ultimate plan is. So it was interesting, and I enjoyed this one. I thought it was another strong episode in a run of Flash that has started to trend upward for me.
And here is where we diverge, because I actually didn't like this episode very much. The reason for it is primarily that I thought the acting from all of the villains except for Jinx was atrociously bad. I thought it was hackneyed, it was over the top, Fat Nails was just
the worst.
Brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, irredeemably bad. I thought the one thing about this episode that I really loved was seeing Barry Allen be a scientist again.
Mm-hmm.
Because we never get to see that. The focus on the show, because they have to validate the existence of characters like Cisco and Caitlin, we see them be the ones that have to do all the problem solving. But here, Barry has to be the problem solver. And it's a nice reminder that he's a freaking brilliant forensic scientist in addition to being the fastest man alive. And I enjoyed that aspect a lot. I did not enjoy pretty much any of the stuff with the villains except Jinx. She was great. And also, holy God almighty, is what I will just refer to as new DeVoe awful. And thank God that certain things happened by the end of the episode, because that guy was a bad actor.
Yeah, not to delve too much into spoilers, but I would like to, you know, I think it's important that in the next episode of Flash, yes, after the return from another random CW mid back half of season break, that the new DeVoe and his wife really get to explore, you know, explore the space, if you will.
In fact, yes, I agree, Nick. In fact, I feel if they took an entire episode,
mm-hmm,
and delved it into the home life of the DeVos, and kind of, you know, there's an old country song, no one knows what goes on behind closed doors. I think the audience needs to know.
Yes, I agree.
So, it's one of those things where sometimes the audience needs to know something that the hero doesn't know. And so I find it vital that we know such a thing, and I'm with you 100% there, Nick. But I kind of misspoke when I said I didn't like the episode. Even when the Flash is down to me, I still enjoy it, so I still enjoyed the episode overall, but I thought it was kind of a down one, and honestly one of the lesser ones for this season, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah, I was obviously a bit higher on it than you were, but you know, I think it's still starting to finally move the DeVoe subplot,
yes,
forward with some momentum.
Agreed.
After kind of some wheel spinning that's been going on for a little while.
The other thing I wanted to mention is I did feel like DeVoe acted a little bit out of character in this episode. And I don't know how to get into that without spoiling stuff, so I won't. But maybe we'll talk about it as the next few episodes unravel and perhaps explain some of his actions. But to me, there was no foreshadowing for some of his behavior in this one. So perhaps it'll be explained, but I thought he kind of – obviously his power is starting to corrupt him.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that. But I think his turn to malevolence has been a little bit swifter than I would have liked. But nonetheless, it's intriguing, and like you said, it's ramping up how things are going from here, and we're starting to perhaps get a better idea of what the end game is, and maybe a little bit of an idea of how the heroes are going to go about attacking him.
Indeed. Yeah, it's going to be... It should make for an interesting close to the season whenever it gets back going once again after another random CW break that makes no sense. Moving on to Black Lightning on Tuesday night, and this is one I'm trying to remember the finer details of. I know we got to see more of Lady Eve as she was digging around in the stomach of a corpse for some reason.
Complete, a corpse that woke up at some point.
Yeah, complete with like squishy sound effects. I didn't really understand what was going on there at all. We got to see more of Jefferson as he struggles with, you know, the role of Black Lightning in the community. You know, he definitely is starting to feel the guilt and starting to already question whether or not it's even worth it for him to be Black Lightning. He's feeling the deaths of LaWanda and the injury to his daughter's boyfriend. And so this episode really just, as has been the case with Black Lightning, isn't so much about the superheroics as it is about, you know, Jefferson Pierce, the guy. And it continues to be so different from the other shows, and I think that is what is helping it to really set itself apart thus far anyway.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this, first of all, another good episode of Black Lightning. But this was one that I think I was the first one that's come along that didn't blow me away. And
right.
I think that's because in some ways this was the most normal feeling of the episodes. What I mean by that is of the first three episodes that we've seen, this is the first one that I could see taking place in one of the other shows,
mm-hmm,
that's on the CW. In that it was much more basic in terms of its plot, much more straightforward. There was a little bit less shades of gray in this one. Obviously, heavy is the head that wears the crown, so we still have that element going with Jefferson. But there were less shades of gray on the sides of the common folk. We pretty well had over-the-top comic book villains, and we pretty well had a line in the sand hero. And we also, you didn't mention her, but we got to see the continuing development of the character that we will know as Thunder eventually, mm-hmm. His older daughter. And that's pretty cool to see her continue to develop. The one element that I keep going back to is this guy that's, I always forget his name, Nick, the tech guy.
Gamby, I believe.
Yes. They're really slow playing where his loyalties lie and why he is keeping secrets from Jefferson, but he continues to not be the strongest actor, in my opinion. But that being said, lot to love here. Even for this was to me again a little bit of a down episode for Black Lightning by its standards, but that's honestly not an indictment of this episode. It's just a praise for how great those first two episodes were. Still a really good episode. Still an amazing lead performance. And particularly enjoying the continued development of Tobias Hoyle.
Hoyle, indeed. And that, of course, leaves us with only Arrow on Thursday night. And this one kind of, you know, it's weird. I know it's going on a break, but this one is the only one of the shows that felt like it had actually earned a break of someone. It felt, in many ways, like a mid-season finale, as it ended with a big reveal, a status quo shake-up for the show, and kind of an indication of where the show is going from here. And I don't want to get too heavy into the spoilers, but I will say I enjoyed it. Even if the ultimate reveal was a little bit predictable, I'm at least more intrigued by this guy than I ever was Caden James, and I am looking forward to seeing where it goes from here, even if I am already just, I am still, dude, so over the bickering between the two respective teams and ready for that to go the way of all things.
Are you tired of it, Hoss?
I'm tired of it. Tired of all of it, damn it.
Yes, Hoss, I agree with you. I, too, am sick of the bickering between the two teams, and by that I mean I'm sick of the other team. They just, particularly Curtis and Renee, they need to go find the nearest circus, go to the area at which cannons are fired, load themselves into the cannon, find a way to light the wick, and point the cannon towards the sun, at which both should be fired. They are annoying characters, and I don't like them. But I say that to preface that I freaking love this episode. This was Arrow to me. This was, kind of picking up on the heels of what started last week, where we're starting to finally see them pick up the pace a little bit and lean more into what makes Arrow, Arrow, which are good mysteries that pay off with things that have been weaving their way through the entire show from the beginning. And again, without spoiling the twists along the way, I thought this did a great job of wrapping up the Caden James arc and aiming us towards what seemed at one time like an inevitable story path, and then for a while we both, I think, thought that they had kind of abandoned. And now we're seeing that everything was not as it appeared to be, and we have our direction towards the latter half of the latter half of the season. And I'm really intrigued to see where it's going to go. I thought this was by far the best Caden James episode since they introduced that character back in. They did a great job of giving that character some motivation, arguably that should have been given from the get-go. They did a great job. I thought the actor did a really good job of portraying that. And I got to be honest, I bought into the mystery. Like you said, it was a little bit predictable. But at the same time, they did a good job of weaving it in throughout the episode to the point where I was questioning myself a couple times on who the big reveal was going to be. And they, did a good job with that. I thought the team dynamics were great. I thought Amel was great. So this was a really good episode. And I am quite interested in how they develop this, how should I put this? change of pace character, how they build that character going forward and how they will portray that character relative to that character's comic book counterpart.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I don't know how, I don't get the impression it's going to be that faithful, but it should make for an interesting status quo shakeup nonetheless. So I guess with all that being said, the only thing left to do is to rank them. I'm not going to use your bizarre pronunciation of the term. I know you can't rank them all, but why don't you start off with your 1 to 3?
I apologize if there are some audio difficulties right now. Our L-shaped studio, there's a thunderstorm overhead that is disrupting the sound here in our studio where we both are in person.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, my rankings, and you said you wanted 1 through 3 or 3 to 1.
It doesn't matter, however you want to do them.
All right, I'll start at number 1, and I will go with Arrow at number 1. I will go with Black Lightning at number 2, and I will go with The Flash at number 3.
Yeah, I'll go Arrow at number 1, Black Lightning at 2, Flash at 3, and Supergirl at 4, which is no knock on Supergirl. I just really enjoyed all the shows this week.
Another good week of CW action. Feels like that, you know, that network is really kicking some ass in the closing stretch so far of their respective seasons. So let us move on to our weekly look at the news and notes of the comic book world. Let's move on to the rundown.
Welcome to the rundown.
What better way to start the rundown, Nick, than with that very special segment, that very special area of the L-shaped studio? You know what I'm referring to, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
It's the DCEU corner.
DCEU corner.
Been a while since we've stepped into the DCEU corner.
You know, it feels like it has been. And we are... appropriately enough, what started the whole DCEU corner? Rumors and speculation.
Yes.
And there's nothing we love more here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys than rumors and speculation. So let's go to the world of the internet, where Mashable editor, former Mashable editor, Josh L. Dickey.
That's the full disclosure. That's the only reason Greg wanted to do this story was so he could say the name Josh L. Dickey.
That is 100% true, ladies and gentlemen. I just wanted to say Josh L. Dickey.
You know, I think we ought to get Josh L. Dickey and Jim Bob Cooter together and see what happens.
Are you suggesting a Dickey Cooter alliance?
I am suggesting that absolutely.
Now, what if Josh L. Dickey and pitcher R.A. Dickey interacted with Jim Bob Cooter? Would that be some sort of menage a trois type experience?
Probably so. You'd have Dickey squared at that point.
So, Josh L. Dickey, the former Mashable editor, claims that Justice League director Zack Snyder did not voluntarily step down from that job as Justice League director, as it was reported at the time last year. Instead, Dickey's assertion, that's Josh L. Dickey, his assertion is that Snyder was fired by Warner Brothers. Here's what he says on the Twitter. Quote, "Since I'm shifting into DGAF mode," whatever that means, Nick.
It means don't give a fuck.
Here's a hot one for you. I was trying to keep it PC there.
Why?
Friend of friends.
Our show is never PC.
You know, that's a good point. Here's a hot one for you, colon. Zack Snyder was fired from the DCEU just over 1 year ago. Couldn't write it quite that way at the time, but was able to tap dance around it. End quote. So, the only reason I did this story was to say Josh L. Dickey's name. What do you make of Josh L. Dickey's statement?
Not that surprising. Something that I think we all thought was at least a possibility in the back of our minds. You know, the story at the time was that it was a mutual parting of the ways so he could focus on his family. But it always felt like there was an element to it that Warner Brothers was kind of getting the outcome they really wanted, which was him off the movie for whatever reason. So this doesn't shock me in the least. And ultimately, it doesn't matter. I mean, we got the, you know, I thought Justice League was a mess of a film. And, you know, nothing is going to change that at this point. It's clear from what we've, from the reports, that the quote-unquote Snyder Cut is too unfinished to ever be released, at least without substantial work. And Warner Brothers has no intention of ever seeing that, so we'll never know what exactly it was that got him fired. So, I don't know, man. I'm not really surprised by this. I'm not, you know, it's just kind of a non-story to me, honestly.
Well, let's go from there to
You have no thoughts. What are your thoughts? It's a two-person show, Greg. We can have a conversation. We can exchange ideas, for God's sake. Do you have any thoughts?
When's the last time I had a thought?
I don't want to answer that. I don't want to tell tales out of skewl.
No, I mean, you know, it's kind of beating a dead horse at this point.
Right.
A dead horse being ridden by former Mashable editor Josh L. Dickey.
Josh L. Dickey, of course, yes.
But
and who the hell is the former editor of Mash, like entertainment editor for Mashable, to be throwing out all these exclusive report colons? Like, come on, that whatever.
It feels like kicking a guy when he's down, and you know there are plenty of places to go on the internet if you want people to shit all over Zack Snyder, and you know we've done it ourselves on occasion, but we like, you know.
Wait a minute, are you suggesting there's an actual video out there of such things happening?
Listen, I am saying that I've heard from Slayton, former WCW play-by-play announcers, that Slayton individuals take a sexual pleasure from watching other people take dumps.
Indeed.
And what that has to do with Zack Snyder, I'm not entirely sure.
Sometimes but they I take those dumps on Zack Snyder, I think is what you're saying.
Right. Also, oddly enough, Zack Snyder was the name that Klondike Bill gave to his glass table.
There you are, Zack Snyder. Anyway, moving on.
Anyway, no, he much to do about, you know, little at this point. So good luck to Zack Snyder as he moves on. Good luck to former Mashable editor Josh L. Dickey.
As he moves on as well.
Exactly. Joaquin Phoenix. What does he have to do with anything? Let me explain. We're going to a weird fringe area of the DCEU corner known as the unnamed, unrelated DC universe that isn't the DCEU.
Let's just call them Elseworlds movies for simplicity's sake for right now, until there's an official banner unfurled.
Corner. So, yes, in the Elseworlds until there's a better official name unveiled corner, we've got this Joker origin movie that we, I believe, have talked about here on the Rundown before.
And how we don't want that movie.
That movie, exactly. Writer-director Todd Phillips and his untitled Joker origin film produced by Martin Scorsese for some reason. According to Variety, Joaquin Phoenix has agreed to play the Joker in this film. Phoenix was considered the top choice by Phillips in late 2017 after Leonardo DiCaprio turned it down or was not able to do it. Studio negotiations have not commenced with Phoenix, but this is who the director wants, and the actor has agreed to it, apparently. The Joker film is said to delve into what it took for the Joker to become a mastermind criminal and take place in the 1980s. Will not be related to the DC Extended Universe, will not be related to Jared Leto's Joker, who will apparently still be a thing separate from this. So, okay. This is just a weird story, Nick. Tell me your thoughts, and then I'll give you mine.
You know, I continue to be skeptical at best of the entire existence of this movie. I think it's a bad idea. I think it shouldn't happen. And I think it's going to be a massive misstep if it ever finally does happen. That being said, I suppose there are worse casting choices you could make than Joaquin Phoenix to play the Joker. Although I gotta be honest, as good as an actor as the guy is, I kind of have a hard time seeing it, and it's not a casting rumor that really fills me with any sort of excitement or redeems the concept of this in any way.
You know, it's weird because it's no secret how little I thought of the Jared Leto take on the Joker. I didn't like it. I didn't like the approach from a writing standpoint, a design standpoint, or an acting standpoint. And thus, the idea of Joaquin Phoenix playing the Joker appeals much more to me because I think more of him as an actor, and I think he's the better fit for that character. And certainly, you would have to expect this would be a drastic departure from the, hot topic punk hipster mob boss version of the Joker.
Yeah, one can only hope, at least
in Suicide Squad. So, and I think very highly of Joaquin Phoenix as an actor. I think he's tremendous. But like you said, this movie just doesn't need to happen. I don't need to know the Joker's origin. I don't need it. I don't want your life, as you mentioned.
I don't need a Joker movie without Batman in it.
The Joker is not a hero. The Joker should not be. The idea of the Joker is antithesis to that of a character going on a heroic journey. You can run that movie with other Batman villains. You could run a movie in which Catwoman is an anti-hero. You can run a movie even in which Two-Face or Poison Ivy or Clayface or some of these other more tortured, conflicted villains could be. The Joker's not conflicted. The Joker is a force of nature. The Joker is a force of evil. And frankly, this has been tried in the comics before. Solo Joker titles. They did it in the 70s. I think they tried it once in the 90s. It never works. You can do a one-off Joker thing, which is this is going to be, I guess, but those only work as supplemental to something else. And it's possible this could work. I'm not going to say there's no chance that this is good, but I'm saying it's a movie that I don't want to see, and it's a movie that's frustrating because there are so many other properties and so many other projects that could get some attention, and it just does nothing to answer the criticism that we've made of Warner Brothers Pictures that they have no idea what they're doing with the DC brand.
I agree completely.
Now, we did get a trailer that dropped this week for a comic book property, and it was the very first teaser trailer for the upcoming Tom Hardy starring vehicle Venom from Sony Pictures. And what's interesting about this teaser trailer, Nick, is Venom doesn't appear anywhere in the movie, in the trailer,
right?
The teaser. And there's honestly, other than the Marvel logo that pops up at the beginning, there is absolutely nothing to indicate that this is about Venom.
Well, you kind of get a glimpse of the symbiote, like
true, in a little tube,
and you
yeah.
start to see like the closing shot is it like reaching out and attaching itself to Eddie Brock or whatever. So there are very brief snippets, but mostly you're right. It kind of feels just like a. I don't even know what it feels like. The most positive thing I can say about it is at least it looks like it's got some production value behind it. Like at least the images look, you know, like a big time, high budget movie, which is a positive sign. But this really does nothing to tell you about the plot of the film or what's going to happen here. I don't even think it really qualifies as a teaser trailer because it doesn't even really like give you that one image you want to see, you know, to get you excited for the next release of more. It kind of just was underwhelming all around. The one thing I did take from it is that it's pretty clear from what I could see, judging by the like scientific lab settings and stuff, that it seems like they're going with the ultimate take on the symbiote in mm-hmm. that it's human engineered rather than of alien origin, which I think is, if you're going to do it without Spider-Man, I think that kind of makes sense to do it that way.
Right. I agree. And I will say, I think there's been a lot of overreaction to this online.
I agree too. Yeah.
It's a teaser. I mean, come on, folks. It's not the end of the world that it didn't show Venom. It's not going to determine how the movie turns out, nor is it, you know, if you like the trailer, nor is it an indication the movie's going to be great. It was just a teaser, and we won't know until later on how things are going to look, how the CGI is going to look. And I think this is, to me, it's done nothing to change my uncertain thoughts on this film. I'm still just as uncertain as I was one way or the other.
Right.
And now we close out the rundown with an utterly bizarre story, at least in my view. And that is the news that came out that 20th Century Fox is developing, to confirm rumors that had been out there, a Kitty Pryde movie directed by Deadpool's Tim Miller, and, as we learned, being written by Brian Michael Bendis, this according to Deadline. The working title is 143, which refers to Uncanny X-Men number 143, an early Kitty Pryde story in the comics. Mm-hmm. Bendis has already retweeted these reports, so that pretty much confirms that it's happening. Now, Bendis just signed an exclusive deal with DC to write comics, but evidently that it doesn't have anything to do with outside projects. So, Bendis, who you have mentioned, Nick, is an avowed
yes
fan of Kitty Pryde to an insane degree, to the point of adding her to his Guardians of the Galaxy book when he was writing it. Now he's pretty much getting his dream job, I guess, of writing a standalone Kitty Pryde movie, which, listen, I love Kitty Pryde. There's no doubt she's a great, great character, but I'm going to need one of our X-Men experts, whether it be Tim or Todd, to come in and kind of sell me on the idea of a Kitty Pryde standalone movie, because I don't know. Maybe it'll be great. Maybe it'll work, but this is just a weird project. Although Bendis writing it is cool, because how often, Nick, do you get to see comic book writers full-time comic book writers brought in to script major Hollywood productions?
Yeah, it doesn't happen often at all, so I think that is an interesting part of it. And I'm with you. I think it's a weird choice for Fox to greenlight, especially in this uncertain time for Fox as a studio. They really don't know how much longer they're going to retain control of this property, so I don't know how much money it makes to be sinking money into such a risky proposition as a Kitty Pryde solo movie at this point. But, as you alluded to earlier, the one thing that does give me a little bit of hope for it, if it does wind up happening, is the fact that, you know, granted, we don't know how well he'll do at writing a movie script, but I can promise you there is nobody who is going to care more about putting out a good Kitty Pryde product than Brian Michael Bendis. He is a massive fan of the character, and he will do everything in his power to do the character justice and bring her to the big screen in a way that will be appealing to a lot of people. So, you know,
that's a great point, Nick. I think, to be fair, I needed to consider that a little bit more before I said my piece. That's a really good point. I didn't take that into consideration about the fact that it is a good thing that somebody that genuinely cares about this character, you know, even though I can kind of, you know, every writer's got their favorites, and I can kind of, you know, hem and haw about whether she's been put into situations that didn't, you know, maybe it wasn't the best for in the comics, but at the same time, his love for this character shines through, and ultimately, if these movies are going to happen, I would rather them be in the hands of people that get and love the character. And I think there's no doubt that Bendis loves Kitty Pryde and will do what it takes, on his end anyway, to present a product that benefits that character and that shines a positive light on that character. The way that that Ryan Reynolds and Tim Miller did with Deadpool. Mm-hmm. So, you know what? I'm not quite as negative on this as I was just a few minutes ago, because I'm still uncertain on the need for a Kitty, or not the, I shouldn't say the need, none of these movies are needed, but on the purpose of a Kitty Pryde movie, standing alone versus in a team aspect. But to your point, that's a good thing to consider, is that at least it's going to be made with love. So
right.
That's good.
Yeah, so there you are.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's the rundown for this week. Let us know your thoughts on that and anything else you'd like to know on Twitter, on Facebook, email, carrier pigeon, Telegraph. I understand Nick just installed a telegraph machine in his house, and so we'll be happy to answer any of those messages about all of the stuff we've talked about. And as for what's coming down the pike, we mentioned earlier in the broadcast that next week we'll be reviewing the Black Panther movie, which will wrap up Black Panther month for us, and then we're going to move into the month of March, and we are going to be bringing back Hard Travelers for Hire as we take a look at Ant-Man, starring Paul Rudd, and we'll be joined by our very special geek and sassy friend Jennifer Smith to review that one. We will then dovetail from that into the rest of March. And what are some of the things we have coming up in March, Nick? I don't even know.
Yeah, well, we have we'll be getting back on our Hard Travelers for Hire series as we welcome in special guest and friend of the show Jennifer Smith to discuss the final film of Phase 2, strangely enough, Ant-Man. You know, I know that's going to be one that will be make for some interesting discussion, as you and I have a little bit of a difference of opinion, although not nearly as passionate as we do on other films like Iron Man 3 and such. But I'm currently looking up our schedule right now to jog my memory, and we also have other things lined up for March, including a long book hunt on Scott Snyder's classic Court and Night of Owls stories, as well as an off-the-page on one of your favorite films, Greg, Spider-Man 2, and a countdown of our top five DC stories of all time. So, interesting topics to tackle in the month of March, if we indeed do wind up sticking with those topics.
And listen, if there's one thing that you can take to the bank, folks, it's that once we tell you we're doing something, we damn well do it. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right, Nick?
Absolutely. And, I can't say necessarily that it's going to happen in the month of March, but there is something else on the horizon as well from the hard-traveling fanboys.
yes. Hopefully the Hernandezes will enjoy it just as much as we will recording it. But yes, we will see what happens in the month of March. We may throw in some surprises here and there. We'll see how it all plays out. But in the meantime, I will let you all leave our show and go back to enjoying the slalom and the curling and the lugeing. And whatever other Winter Olympic sports are striking your fancy. Do stick with us as we return next week, won't you?
Hard traveling fanboys. Sorry, I had a fight in the middle of your Black Panther party.